Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce.
Today, I'm speaking with Mark Haas, CEO of The Helmsman Group, a company that helps food and beverage brands develop sustainable, scalable, and profitable CPG products. Mark and his team act as an extension of companies including Magic Spoon, 88 Acres, Urban Remedy, Kellogg's, and a little company called Haven's Kitchen. Helmsman specializes in all things product, from conceptualization, design, and development, food safety, market validation, commercialization, and supply chain, and they've helped over 200 new products enter the commercial market, generating more than $2 billion in sales over the last decade. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Allie. Thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here. I really like having people on that I've worked with because I feel like this is one of those like really good opportunities for people to understand how best to work with you, and hopefully also just get you business because you deserve it. So this is a fun one for me. Okay. So you've been doing this a long time. You've been in this world for a while. You've known the trends, you've seen things come and go. I guess, you know, I'd like a couple of just sort of big picture, overarching thoughts about CPG with relation to innovation today, and maybe a little bit about what shifted in the past few years from your perspective.
Well, I mean, as specialists in product, we work with innovation all the time. I like to make certain that everybody understands what innovation really means. A lot of times innovation to some mean, you know, changing an ingredient or taking advantage of a trend, which is great. It's a great way to build business. It's a great way to build awareness, but that's not really innovative. Innovation is a transformation. It could be packaging. It could be a new product type or something very novel. So when Beyond Meat, for example, came on the market, that was pretty innovative. We hadn't had a high quality, great tasting meat analog in quite some time. So that, you know, fast forward several years, we've seen innovation in plant-based products, which I think is a slightly overused term, but the alternative milks, other plant-based proteins that eat well, that are desirable by consumers, those are transformative and innovative. A lot of times we design new products. What's old is new again. I think that's the way I like to phrase it. So we've seen a lot of products come and go through cycles. In the 30 years that I've been doing product development and innovation in, you know, for lots of stalwart brands, Kashi, Hain Celestial, Annie's, others, I've sold fiber 4 times now. So we've designed a lot of products with fiber, probiotics, prebiotics, you know, fiber again for digestive gut health. You know, ingredients come and go with, you know, different reasons for favor. Yeah, exactly. Flavors come and go. Right now in the world of We've seen a lot of cake flavors in sweet goods come and go, red velvet, birthday cake, things of that nature. But what I think is truly innovative, something that we've been focused on here at Helmsman for almost 5 years, is the application of artificial intelligence to how food and beverage works. Food and beverage, which I'm sure you know, is pretty complicated. There's a lot of sensory analysis, which is really difficult to calibrate. In our project together, we spent a few months just getting the flavors right, getting the claims right, and having tools that help you advance that time frame to move forward, to take advantage of first mover opportunities, to be first on shelf, to create the category captain that is really important for taking these new concepts. Your product is, your aioli is vegan, which I'm sure your listeners have heard before, but developing a vegan mayo-like condiment was really challenging. There was a lot of technological application that we put into how we developed that product for you so that it could be cooked.
Did we use AI on our product?
We did not use AI on your product.
Because I was like, all I need to do then is go put that in a pitch deck and pitch myself to every VC as an AI. Forget food science. This is like, you know, or food tech. This is like food AI. Yeah. But I guess I can't do that. So I'm back to my regular sales deck. Okay.
Not in the development of your product, but we do use AI as a tool in how we manage the reams of data. So when you look at an ingredient, and maybe not everybody knows this, so this is important to understand, most ingredients will have anywhere from 10 or more, you know, 20 or 30 is not improbable, support document subjects. So food safety criteria, 100 gram nutritionals, technical data sheets, organic certification, non-GMO project verification certification, and so on and so forth. There's many attributes that you would have. And each one of those documents has, you know, two or more pages of data associated with it. It's not uncommon for an ingredient to have over 100 pages of support documentation with 16 different regular, or up to 16 different regulatory agencies having some jurisdiction over how food is brought to market and how it's being regulated. It's increasingly difficult to manage that volume of information and remain in full compliance. And that's how we deploy the AIs. What's going on? What's current? Are there dates that have lapsed that require us to update information? And how we manage the flow of information. So when you give us feedback on sensory, what is the acid sweet balance? What is the brightness of the jalapeno pepper? What is the vegetal or herbaceousness of the cilantro and whatever we're designing for you? And is it too much? Is it too little? Is it, you know, just right? So you've gone through that process. You've seen firsthand how our methodology, our sensory methodology, works to get you, well, in this case, not quite an award, but award-winning proposition.
Yeah, and amazingness. I mean, truly amazingness. And so, I know that you have sort of, I mean, can you just explain what Regulate is? Because I feel like you're taking all of this and you've basically built a database to power that efficiency that you're talking about. And I, you know, it's science-y, so I'm going to ask you to explain.
Sure. So we developed Regulate, which is this AI platform that we've been describing in this conversation. It is pretty complex. It's a enterprise level, sophisticated, multi-module program that breaks down the product lifecycle management into components that make sense. So we have an ingredient module. We have a recipe management module, a food safety module, a project management module, and all the things that relate to bringing a product to market, manufacturing, packaging, other compliance factors, nutrition facts, all of that. And what we've done historically as an industry is we've relied on either people, individuals who are subject matter experts in regulatory interpretation, or just lots of different contributors, right? Amazingly, and I'm sure this doesn't surprise you, but it may surprise several, is even the large organizations, the large strategics, the multi-billion, multinational, large corporations, they manage the data the same way. And that is with email and file servers and conversations. Spreadsheets is probably the most common way of managing this information. And so that means time is every one of these projects are pretty inefficient in modern standards compared to other industries. If we were looking at the automotive industry or the defense industry or other similar high-tech industries, they take a long time to develop an airplane or a car, which I'm thankful for. So the safety is put into that, you know, the design criteria. But we in the food and beverage industry don't really have tools to do that. We don't have the ability to organize this. And so it requires people, lots of different people, lots of different areas of expertise, years, you know, 2 or 3 years often in the strategics to design, develop, and launch a new product. And so we have organized all of that information so that nearly at the speed of light, the areas where key decisions need to be made and the judgment from the subject matter expert can be placed to make a decision is brought front and center. So we all have some experience with ChatGPT where we can write a prompt and say, write me a PhD thesis on whatever, right? Some interpretation of art and some, you know, political aspect, and it'll write something for you. It may not be high quality, but the sense of, or the essence of it is there. And so if you are an expert in what the subject is that you're having the computer author for you, you can say, okay, I understand what's going on here now, and then put the last, the finishing touches on it. And that's what our system does. Our system is better than ChatGPT because we used a very focused, here's a big data science word, And so we're focused on food and beverage only and the elements that we've talked about. And so the system is hyper-focused and hypersensitive with all of the FDA regulations embedded into the backbone of the system.
Yeah, I love that. Ooh, we'll use it on our next thing.
We are using it on our next thing. It's actively being used. It's actively being used. We, you know, two of the biggest areas of improvement in the database for your projects, you know, ones that we're working on together with you today, are the three areas. One, we can generate cost cards instantaneously. So if we have a question about cost and
margin,
we can answer that question for you in the moment. Live during
that's amazing.
We give you the tools. You can log into the system. You can see for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and so just so everyone understands, I want to actually interrupt for a second because I want to go back to my last podcast. I was talking with Anna Whiteman about, you know, her sort of thesis after Expo West. She's an investor. Was basically that there was this like back to pragmatism, both in the way that, you know, businesses are building themselves. They're not saying we're going to, you know, quadruple our first year. They're not saying we're going to be profitable in 3 months. They're not saying we're going to get this distribution even, you know, without any sort of grounding in a real true bottoms up. Those years are done. And also a pragmatism when it comes to the products. And I thought it was kind of interesting because it all felt sort of tidy, you know, what she saw at Expo West this year. And I have to agree, wasn't so much like stuff that felt like the consumer would be wanting in 4 or 5 years, but it's stuff that the consumer wants now, but just made either a little bit better for you or a little bit tastier. And the sort of like function at all costs, even when there isn't a clear consumer need or desire, or it's still very niche, sort of took a back seat to a lot of really delicious food at this year's show. And one of the things we were talking about was that, you know, maybe someone like me a few years ago would have come to you and said, I want these 5 flavors. We would have worked on those 5 flavors and I would have had a target margin for them. And you know, they would have come back in that target, except one of them came back out of the target. And if I'm being totally honest, a few years ago, I would have been like, oh, it's fine. You know, what's a couple points? But mm-hmm. the pragmatic thing that's happened to someone like me as a founder in this space is, no, that's actually not okay. Like, I'm not going to be releasing that product because those 3 points, when that SKU becomes your number one SKU, mm-hmm. really can change the whole business. So I just want to give everyone who's listening a little context when, because when you and I are going back and forth and I'm saying, I need a little bit more punchy, or I feel like it's a little too, you know, a little too salty, or I'd like a little bit more from the pepper, you can type in ding ding and we can literally in real time see what that does to the margin. That's mm-hmm. really cool. Like yeah. that's one thing that, like, I don't know about all the rest, but that is very cool just to have that right at my fingertips the next time we talk.
Well, we should do that live. You know, that's that's a real life case study because yeah. you designed, I think, 6 products for you for this launch. You're launching mm-hmm. 4. One yeah. of them, my favorite, and you and I discussed this briefly at Expo, was short on your launch margin yep. by 2 or 3 margin points.
Yep.
I think it'll be one of your best products, but we've got to go back and dial it in a little bit. And yep. why not use this, you know, platform to do that?
Yeah, no, it's great. So on top of, you know, what we just talked about a little bit was my process with you. I'm probably not your average. I don't know. I don't know. Y'all tell me. But other than like the project that I just described. Mm-hmm. So let's break down the buckets of what Helmsman does before we go to break so that we can get a really clear idea so that, you know, people kind of understand what you do. So maybe just tell me sort of the way that you define the buckets and then maybe what a deliverable for each one of those things looks like. So I would imagine co-packer and ingredient sourcing means you have mm-hmm. a vetted list of ingredients that meet the criteria and you've identified the co-packer that will be able to produce it. But obviously there's things leading up to that. So maybe take that away.
Sure. We like to start most every project with a feasibility assessment. A lot of times we have early stage founders who have a really good idea for how to bring a product to market, but they don't understand the requirements, either the process techniques or, you know, we've had requests for aseptic production, which is usually associated with beverages, or other retort, which is a canning process for making a meat product, for example. And the minimum order quantities, the MOQs associated with either of those can be extraordinary. And so we want to really understand from the client, are you prepared for the costs of taking this all the way through to market, or should we reevaluate what is it that you're trying to achieve? So that's basic feasibility. So we do some what we call paper-based concepts, what we think an analogous product might cost. Are you prepared for this? Are your target prices, you know, geared towards taking this to market? Do you understand the different touch points in a supply chain, the distributor markups, what the distributor will or won't do in terms of paying you on time or entirely, margin expectations of a retailer and different trade channels that you're operating in? So those are really nuts and bolts. Are you ready for this process? That's the feasibility piece. Once we get through that, and we ask our clients to complete what we call a product attribute form, which is, what do you want the product to be? Who are you trying to serve? Who are the demographics? What's the reason for a consumer to buy this? What are their reasons to buying the product? What is your brand message? What's your brand purpose? We really want to get behind and immerse ourselves in what the brand is, so that as we begin the design of the product, we really bring out the elements of the brand so it's obvious to the consumer. There's a claim, there's a call out, there's something on the front of package. It resonates, especially if this is your second product. Your first product, you want to have strong product awareness, brand awareness for the product to be positioned. The second is actually harder, in my opinion, than the first, because you have some success from the first. Now we have to replicate that success, but we have to do it in a way that is adjacent to or complementary to the product that you've had your first success with. It would be really difficult to launch a potato chip from an ice cream brand. That doesn't make sense. And so making certain that that's clear, then we start going into the design, the wireframe of what the product will be, and we put together the concept brief. So now we're illustrating back to you what we think this is, what the serving size might be, what the claims and callouts are likely to be, what the process technology is going to be, how that's going to work in a commercial setting. And once we're aligned, one more document, we have to get really granular. We have to go through and understand all of the specific claims, all of the nutritional requirements, what the guardrails are, whether you have a retail compliance requirement. Whole Foods has a, the not list, right? What they won't allow in their store, and they're not the only one. And so we have to make certain that we're very clear on what your requirements are, because as soon as we go into our test kitchen to initiate the process, we want to be vigilant and efficient. The better we can design the product up front and show you different expressions, different variations of how the different ingredients interplay, we will ask questions. And I know we did this with your projects, is how are you naming the product? Is it strawberry banana or is it banana strawberry? Because we want that to be obvious to the consumer, which one is hitting first and which one is the linger in a flavor example. And so that it's just so incredibly organic to the consumer. And I think the number of awards that we have helped our client brands achieve speaks to that process. We break that process down into two phases, protocepting, which is a term that we use. You know, some other agencies use it. It's a made-up word. It means the convergence of a concept and a prototype. So it's before we get to the prototype, we're just making tangible expressions. We're going through a sensory analysis. We use a jar process, which is just about right.
Right. I had trouble with the with the jar process. You were like, no, just it's like a 1, 2, or 3. And I'm like, it's like a 1.65, like, or whatever it was. I remember it.
Yeah, we interpret that. We need to understand. So the jar process for the listeners is, it's kind of like golf where you're closest to the pin. And we call it the Goldilocks methodology, where a 3 is just about right. And a 1 or a 2 is not enough of something in different degrees. And a 4 or 5 is too much of something. Right. And so if we were making a garlic aioli for you and you wanted this to be very garlic forward, well, how strong is that? We can't really calibrate that other than doing a tasting together. And we might think it's a 5, way too much garlic. And you might say it's a 2. I wanted a lot of garlic. Did you not hear
right.
me?
You're
and
right.
So we calibrate and then we converge and we bring that to you. And then we look for problems, compatibility, functionality in the ingredients. In the case of your sauce, is it going to break? We wanted this to be shelf stable, and a lot of really unique ingredients in the composition of what we made, but shelf stable oil emulsions going through a cooking process, that's pretty challenging.
Yep.
But we nailed it.
You nailed it. And then the last piece of that, gets to like actually having one of the things that I really like. This is one of those things where I think as a brand, everything is going to be expensive. Everything's going to feel expensive. The difference between one agency and another agency or service provider and another or a partner isn't as much about that. It's about the value of what you get for what you pay. And to me, the partnership, the troubleshooting, the understanding the foundation about the brand and about our messaging. You weren't making products for us in a bubble. You were really engaged with like, what are you calling this and how are you positioning this and how are you positioning it different from each other and also from your other line? But then also at the end of it, we get this big chunky deliverable of, here's who's going to make it. And here's where you're going to get your ingredients from. And to me, that's why we're just going to basically keep working with you on everything, because to me that was sort of priceless. So we're going to go to a quick break, and we'll be right back and continue with Mark Haas from Helmsman.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm back with Mark Haas, founder and CEO of the Helmsman Group, and we're talking about innovation. And before the break, we were talking about sort of the steps along the way, a little bit of how you divide up the work and the way that you partner with brands, both big and small. Let's talk about the small ones or the emerging ones for a minute. And let's just really briefly, like, when is, if we're doing the just about right scale of a brand coming to you, what's the three? Like, when should they come? When is too early in your opinion? And when is too late in your opinion?
I don't think you're ever too early, but there is a preparedness with the founder. You know, is the founder a serial entrepreneur? Have they done this before? And are they at stage zero? Are they, you know, just embarking on this? So that's the perfect time to engage with us. You understand what's going on. You have been through the process before, the process being, you know, building a business and a brand and taking it all the way to exit. And you want to do it again, but in a different territory for, you know, right. that's your design. And so coming to us at that point, partnering with us, we have two clients right now that meet that requirement. They have, you know, successful serial entrepreneurs and all over the CPG industry. They've come to us to ultimately, it's about efficiency. Time is money. Mm-hmm. And so working with us gets you that recipe quicker, prevents in some ways, rarely have we ever seen a new concept be so new that there is only one brand working on the same concept. Mm-hmm. Trends, we're exposed to trends all the time.
Yeah.
We often get called on nearly exactly the same concept. And so we work with typically the individual or group that has come to us first. We, you know, generally work that way, unless they're just not prepared.
Right.
Part of the answer to your question, though, is have they, this is going to sound a little tongue in cheek, but have they experienced enough pain to understand the value of what we bring to the table?
Mm-hmm. yes, I have.
That is, you know, we're quite good at what we do.
Yeah.
But we're a tool, right? We're not magicians. We don't possess magic wands and crystal balls. And so we're very immersed in our industry. We understand what you're looking for. But if you have a hard time articulating precisely what you want to do, how you want to go to market, what you want to provide to consumers, what your point of differentiation is, maybe you're not quite ready.
Well, it really reminds me of my conversation that I had with Taja from, I'm not recalling the name of her agency, but it's a design agency. And I think it's the same in marketing too. It's like, you know, everyone wants to get to the part where we make the ad or we do the photo shoot. Right. Mm-hmm. But the real work is the foundation of what are we saying? To whom are we speaking? Because that will then be the DNA of what will eventually be a fun photo shoot. But it's hard because people kind of want to skip that part because that's tough. That's like you're in the weeds and you're struggling and you're mucking about and it'll be fine. I'm sure, whatever, there'll be someone who will want this, but you know, all of that, that's where like the real sort of like, you know, your mandate comes in. And I think, you know, whether it's because we've had enough pain or because we've done this with a little bit of a wavering mandate in the past, those of us who have done it before know how important it is to know how, what are you comfortable with X amount of sugar? Do you want flavors that are, you know, this far apart from each other? Or are you naming them things like in our case that are perhaps a little bit more understood than the names that you've used in other things? Like all of those things go into the mandate a little bit. And that's the stuff I think that the experience brings, as opposed to I have a really great idea for a cookie.
Yeah. We get projects like that routinely. Yeah. All my friends say that this is the best cookie that they've ever had. And so yes, I should, you know, go into business and make a cookie. And right, we call that, you know, the Aunt Paula's cookie recipe test. we have names for these. And so probably a rule of thumb for all of the early stage founders out there.
Yeah.
It's encouraging to hear from your friends and family about you quitting your day job and starting your cookie business, but they're not really consumers and they're doing you a disservice potentially. And so, you know, my advice, go make some cookies on your own, try to sell them at a farmer's market or something like that. And if you get a bunch of strangers telling you that this is the best cookie they've ever had, now you've got something, because they're going to be pretty unfiltered. And if they don't like it, they'll tell you that too. And if they don't like it, you know, that should give you pause to say, is this for me? Is this the right product? You know, I really want to do this, but am I going about this the right way?
And the shelf, you know, today I did a ride along with our local distributor. You know, obviously my job right now is selling aioli. And I went to all of these amazing, you know, smaller, you know, maybe one or two chain stores in Brooklyn. And, you know, just the number of condiments on the shelf. Now to me, of course, I'm like, but there's no other flavored mayo. Okay, that's true. But there is a lot of condiments on, you know, 12 linear feet. And by the way, that's more space than what I have for the fresh. So, you know, I think we've talked about this. If there are 230 episodes, this has probably been on like 20 of them. But even if Aunt Paula's cookie is genuinely the best cookie everyone's ever had, and you've made it for farmers markets, two things need to happen next. One is on the shelf, where does it go and how much space does it take? And what are those other cookies that are around it? What are they costing and how are they marketing themselves? And how would that, what would be your point of differentiation? And then I think also is what you do, which is where I kind of, my question for you a little bit is like, when someone comes to you with Aunt Paula's cookie, there are going to be times where you will just say, the reason why this is the most delicious cookie ever is because you made it yesterday in your home kitchen. This does not commercialize. Unless I'm wrong and, you know, you can commercialize everything, but there's just going to be some trade-offs. I mean,
no, cookies are a really good example for that. No, you're 100% right. Not everything can be commercialized. In fact, that's the biggest point of differentiation that I would say about our agency versus a culinary agency. So we have a lot of prospective clients that come to us and, you know, they're telling us how they were working with an amazing chef and they're making these really fantastic products. And we say, that's wonderful. And so now you have a concept, you have a spark starter of what to make, you know, an idea, but, you know, what compromises are you willing to make? And that's, mm-hmm. that's a little bit shock and awe. I don't want to make any compromises. Well, if you want to be profitable, make money, we may have to have that cost conversation. If mm-hmm. you want the product to be shelf stable, well, you know, we're probably going to have to go through some sort of preservation process to do that. And that is likely to degrade the color or the quality or the flavor right. or the intensity of the ingredient. How do you think we should go about managing that to meet consumer expectations? A great chef can make great food that will be plated and eaten and enjoyed in 5 minutes. We're mm-hmm. asked to design food that's supposed to be the same nutritionally, color, flavor for as much as 2 years, depending on the type of process and package. And it has to be the same day one and day 700. And that's the key difference with what we do versus a culinarian or a chef. We work with chefs all the time. We think they're amazing. They're incredibly creative. They understand flavor. They understand combinations and trends. And they're the best at trends. They're always focusing on trends. But they can't translate their recipe to a CPG item typically.
Right. So we did a little bit of when, what, you know, I always feel like, you know, I mean, if I'm being totally honest, when you guys send over those things that we have to fill out, I'm mm-hmm. always like slightly impatient with them. 'Cause like in my brain, I'm like, well, they know. But it's, you know, as much as like my instinct is impatience, I actually also love the process because that process makes me actually put things on paper that mm-hmm. I care about or I don't care about or, mm-hmm. you know, are important to me about, you know, whether it's the flavor, the texture, who else is in there, you know, and of course there's the numbers. Ingredients mm-hmm. that I want to stay away from, all of those things. I mean, even to give a practical example, you know, we didn't have a clear mandate about whether or not the aioli should be vegan when we first mm-hmm. started with you. And right. what that did was that brought up a whole discussion internally about is plant-based one of our core tenets as a company? Is everything we make forever going to be vegan? You know, the fresh sauces just happened to be, you know, honestly, mm-hmm. like there was never any reason to put anything dairy or, you know, meat based in there, or egg, but this, it was like, I didn't really want to deal with thinking about it, but it was really good for us to think about it. So I guess the next question is about the what. You know, the most effective way, you know, what a company should do or should have ready for you, both like sort of in terms of what they want, but also in terms of, again, going back to that foundation mm-hmm. that makes it the most cost effective and the easiest for you to get to the next step with them?
Well, focus is incredibly important. What do you stand for? What is your brand? What is your purpose? And mm-hmm. who are you fulfilling? And so what I say often, and even to our team here, is I have to remind people, we have a North Star. Our North Star is, while we may be product experts and we can do a lot in product, and that's our area of expertise, that's our bread and butter, our North Star is helping CPG brands be businesses and be profitable, because that's really what you're doing. You are a business, and it doesn't do you any good for me to make an amazing product that can't be commercialized. That's a failure. And so, but not every agency or every individual would subscribe to that philosophy. And so we often, and I think what you're describing is some of the process that you went through. I can't say it was deliberate what we did, but it wasn't with this outcome per se. But a lot of what we're doing is de-risking your business, especially for future investors. You know, I don't recommend any brand go off and shoestring. I mean, you can start with a shoestring. You pretty much have to start with a shoestring and self-investment and everything else in CPG. We don't really have venture capital investors in CPG. And there's friends and family, and there's ways to attract venture capital. But professional investors, which is where you want to go, they're looking at your business and the team, right? Is the product relevant? Do consumers want it? And those are sort of obvious questions, and you should be able to tick the box on that. And you can be pretty diverse with what you're bringing to market, because there's a niche and a reason for just about anything. But is the member focused? Is the founder focused? Do they understand this is a business? What are they going to do with the capital that I put into this business? Will I see a return on my investment? And we understand that very well. And we want you to be successful in the marketplace. And so we look at it from that perspective. And we're looking for ways to constantly de-risk what you're working on so that, I mean, margin is a focus. We always talk about it. What trade channel you're taking it to, you know, it matters. It matters how it's going to be packaged. It matters how it's going to be presented on shelf. It matters. You wouldn't take something to, you know, Kroger for the intention of selling it at Costco and vice versa. I mean, maybe, but there's different ways of delivering those products that make sense. And one thing that we've done, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, but we built a pilot plant here that is fully accredited with FDA, USDA. We can do spirits and brewery. We have relationships with many retailers up and down the West Coast, Good Food Holdings, which is New Seasons, Bristol Market, Lazy Acres, a lot of small regional retailers, Costco and Target as well, Sprouts. We have a professional relationship through an agency that we work with routinely, so Whole Foods. The concept that we built for our pilot plant, the reason why we've gone through the rigor of having all of the different accreditation, USDA meat and poultry. I mean, we have the ability to take any product to market. And on the surface, it may seem expensive to work with us in terms of being able to produce 1,000 units, but it's a heck of a lot less expensive than the risk of spending $100,000, $200,000 on your first production run at the minimum order quantities. And then that moment in time where everybody gasps and says, I have truckloads of inventory ready to sell and I don't have one customer. What do I do? And so building a transactional learning is what we call it, taking that, being able to take that product to commerce in very small quantities and test your sales strategy, test your marketing position, have consumer conversations, run screeners, run market, different kinds of market analysis, A/B testing on pricing, A/B testing on product flavors in similar channels or different channels.
Yeah. On messaging on the box. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything. I mean, the font size, the font placement.
Yeah. Can you do that literally with any of the products that you've made? You have all the different machines and
most
things.
Yeah. Most.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't
most.
Even know that.
So we have some aseptic fillers. There's a couple things we can't do because the test equipment that we have is, I'm going to use some science terms now. You have to have a hermetic seal for aseptic processing. So this is mm-hmm. a pH above 4.6. And so you think alternative milks, an oat milk, for example. There are shelf-stable mm-hmm. oat milks and there are refrigerated oat milks. We could produce the aseptic refrigerated oat milk with the equipment that we have. We couldn't do the shelf-stable. That's one limitation we have. That's pretty expensive. But we could produce your condiments.
We could.
But we couldn't do it in the package that you want. So there's some limitations. Right.
Understood.
So we could have put it in a jar or a bottle or something to that nature. Beverages, we don't really have any limitations. We can cover the gamut on beverages.
And that's really helpful because those are some big MOQs.
Yeah.
I want to get to the next thing, which is how.
Sure.
You know, we did when, what, everyone knows why. But I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I feel like our teams work very well together.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's just been a really good, you have become part of our team in a lot of ways, but you also hold us accountable in ways that we might not always hold ourselves accountable. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. But I have my thoughts. I want to hear your thoughts. Like, if this mm-hmm. is a really solid working relationship, I imagine that some of them haven't been, as we mm-hmm. all have. Yeah. What are the things that you've identified that other brands and businesses can learn from? I think when they're working with you, but probably is my guess when they're working with any service provider, any sort of outsourced teams, like what have been the sort of hallmarks of our working relationship? And I don't mean you and me, just so everyone listens, understands, this is not a me thing. This is our whole ops team. Our sales team has been involved. Our marketing team has been involved. Mm-hmm. It's multifunctional, multidimensional. So generally, Haven's Kitchen and Helmsman, go.
Right. So it has to do with the collaboration and intent, right? So a client comes to us, or any other service provider, it could be a marketing company, it could be an accounting agency. It doesn't really matter, to your point. You're coming to a professional service organization for guidance and advice. There are some clients that will either put a shield up and not give you enough information to help them make the right decisions, mm-hmm. or they will be very prescriptive and, you know, I need you to do this, and they want to tell you exactly how to do it. And that's fine. It's your business. It's your brand. But you're not getting the most out of the relationship. And so right. if there was more open questions, I understand your point, but why aren't we doing this? There's a moment of education opportunity. So mm-hmm. there's reasons why professional agencies, as subject matter experts in whatever their field is, are giving you suggestions. If they just don't right. get it, like you're choosing a color that is very specific or near and dear to you or the brand, that shouldn't matter as much as why we're choosing, I don't know, in this case, a process technology. Like, we simply can't right. make the product for you in compliance with regulations. We don't want to hurt people. That's not possible. Right. And so
right.
There's reasons.
Do you think that are they worried that, you know, sometimes people get so nervous that other companies are going to somehow steal their ideas, or do they not have a good system for communicating with you? Like, why do you think that happens? Like, what is that?
Some of us, just the individual. I mean, that's who they are. And so right. we can't really help in that situation. There's anxiety that occurs for sure, mm-hmm. which is you're holding me accountable. I have to make a decision. I came to you. I want you to tell me. I want mm-hmm. to, and it's not really about monetary liability. It's just, I want to be able to say that you told me to do this and I did that. And our job as an agency is, well, it's your company. You have to make the decision. We're going to take you right. to a point of choices, and we're right. going to get as close as possible to what you want. And we're going to explain why one option, maybe we'll give a recommendation. We always do that. But it's not our business. It's not our position to make a decision. And so asking questions, seeking advice, you know, that's one thing I tell all of our clients when they're fully engaged in a project. I am involved to some degree, but I'm not immersed in every project. And so I do reach out to clients and say, you should take advantage of mm-hmm. my knowledge, my experience, my expertise in the field, and book a time with me from time to time to just ask me those burning questions. How do I right. deal with this investor? How do I, you know, I don't know what I'm doing in my go-to-market strategy. Mm-hmm. That humility of being that vulnerable, especially in a more probably private situation one-on-one
right.
is huge.
That
because
the trust. Yeah.
Between the parties. And, mm-hmm. and, but I can, then I understand where you're coming from. It's like, okay, you just don't understand how this trade channel works, or you just don't understand mm-hmm. the sort of the implications of these large minimum order quantities. Let's break this down a little bit and get to a point where you're a little bit more comfortable.
Right.
We had one client one time that asked us to make some iced tea for them. And we said, sure. And we were working with a facility and we made the iced tea, and it was the most exciting moment. These were early stage founders. They saw their product coming down the line. It was packaged. It was going. And it was early in the morning. It was at a plant startup. And we left to go to breakfast. And we came back an hour and a half later. And they said, so when did they start the next flavor? And I said, sometime around 10 o'clock tonight. This was, you know, 8 in the morning. Mm-hmm. They said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you asked for 6 containers of iced tea. This is how long it's going to take.
Oh, no. And they thought it was like 6 like little bottles?
No. They understood exactly what they were signing up for.
Oh, okay. They just didn't know how long it would take. Yeah.
No, it was the moment in time when they realized the volume of what 6 containers truly represents for first production.
It. Right.
And the head of sales just looked at me and said, I have to sell all of this? I said, well, yeah.
It is interesting. If you haven't done it, I've had moments like that where I don't think I ever had a moment. If anything, the first time I went to like a really pro co-packer, I was in like desperate need of product. So I was happy that it kept going, but I didn't know how trial and error it can be even once you have everything set. So everything's set, you've got your thing, you got your process, you're ready to rock and roll. But like anything for the first time, the team is getting used to it. You know, does one good ingredient go in first and then the next? What's the easiest way to get the ingredients, you know, in, out? Like it is a humbling experience going to an actual production of a food product. It's kind of like anything else in the world. You don't know what goes into it until you actually experience it. And then you're amazed that any of this gets done ever. I'm amazed. I'm looking at that shelf today in Brooklyn thinking, wow, there are a lot of products, and like all of these people are, it's happening. It's happening consistently. They're selling, they're building teams, they're making things for people, they're making people's lives like more enjoyable. Like it is kind of awesome. And there's definitely some food that I would never eat again, just knowing that they haven't necessarily taken the steps that they need to, like you were talking about earlier. I think sometimes there's stuff out there that I don't know that everyone's been as compliant.
We see all kinds of inconsistencies, especially with labels. But you know, to your point, there's nothing more satisfying, and I've experienced it. I heard you just experience it. Every founder experiences this. When you go into a store and you see your product on shelf and you have this pride and you think back about all of the time that you invested to get that product there and you see it, and then you see other people buying it or trying it or a demo table. When you're at a demo table and people are like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, where has this been? And just that satisfaction that you did the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I reference this moment a lot too. I think most founders that I know and I'm friendly with, we have that. And then immediately 4 seconds later, we have like, oh shit, you know, like now I have to do this in, you know, I don't know, thousands and thousands more stores, and how are, you know, it feels overwhelming. But I also saw something on LinkedIn today, where basically he was like, founders are just insane. Like we're just, you know, crazy. And in a way that's just reality. I mean, I think we're making things that didn't exist before. We're like willing things into the world, because we believe that they should be there. And that we all know the odds are absurd. And yet my guess is if you're listening to this podcast, you're already diving in. So welcome to the world of, you know, the cuckoo bears. General thoughts on what, you know, you hear from a lot of brands and a lot of people. what would you say is the common denominator that like gets your like stomach like, yay, and the common denominator that gets your stomach like, I don't know, this might not be a good fit?
It's the chemistry between really myself and the founder. I advocate for our clients all the time. There's times when, some of our staff members don't understand precisely what's going on. Maybe they don't have the experience. But we persevere through, and I teach and mentor and coach my staff as well, which is you have to put yourself in their shoes. They're on an island. The founders are on an island. They're by themselves. They don't have a peer group. Build a peer group. Right? That's some advice. So find some other founders in the same spot. Have that opportunity to either brainstorm, commiserate, whatever it is that you need to do. You need some sort of catharsis too. You're doing a lot. And, so what I advocate for with our clients that are in that anxiety-ridden moment of making decisions is like, well, take a beat. Let's understand where they are individually and personally. They're maybe tapping into their life savings to bring their dream to reality. And, it's overwhelming at times. And so, that's one piece of it. The other piece of it is, it doesn't happen very often. I think we have a pretty good vetting process, but we've had a couple of founders in the past that are so prescriptive and so directive. It's just not a good fit. And
it would take the fun out for you. Yeah.
Well, it's just, not only does it take the fun out, it, demotivates. I mean, we're people too. We're a service provider, but my people are here to serve you, to help you, to achieve what you want. And when it's a difficult conversation over something that really shouldn't be that difficult, we have to reexamine the relationship.
Yeah. Last question, and it's a pretty practical one, but, I forgot to ask earlier, is it best for you to have one source of truth, one, a project manager, someone on the operations team? Like, it can't always be the founder. But is it best for you to just have that sort of one owner on the other side, just so that, the messages are clear? And I'll say that just because I'm not that owner, but I also find myself when I'm not in that discussion, I definitely find myself wanting to be in that discussion. And I grapple with it a little bit, as I feel like a lot of founders do. So I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So your situation's a little bit different because your team is a little larger than some of the earlier stage founders that we work with. And so when we have earlier stage founders, we're here to help. We have a project manager assigned to every project that is guiding the entire process. And we even say in our project charter, if you have outside agencies, we're willing to lead that project on your behalf so you're not bogged down. That's an anxiety-ridden moment, and that's just going to compound issues that you have because you're trying to deal with so many other things, raising money, go-to-market strategy, brand and design. You're needed to make those key decisions and not be involved in the day-to-day actions. Your team was broad enough and mature enough that you had two, actually, project managers in your business. One was in operations, one was in marketing. We worked well together. Having one be sort of the decision maker for where we are in this particular project, I think, is the best advice I can give. And then they, in this case, interact with our project manager, and we're asking questions or scheduling or coordinating in how our two agencies or our agency and your business worked together best is you would come in on, for the questions that we had for you. So it was, I think, pretty efficient for the most part.
Yeah.
And allowed you to make, to influence the outcome or provide the guidance or the direction setting that was needed. It is, after all, your business, but you don't need to be involved in scheduling meetings and ingredient selection and things of that nature.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it was a lot of fun, round one. Yeah. We're working on a couple of SKUs to extend this aioli line, and we're talking about other lines. I first of all just want to thank you, because the aioli is just an absolute dream product for me to now go out and sell, because everyone just loves it so much, and it is true innovation, and yet also feels like it's not super way out kind of, you know, kooky. So thank you for that. And thank you also for being a guest on the show, because I think this is going to be really helpful. I don't think we've ever had anyone come on to talk about any of the innovation product development side of things. So thank you, Mark.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And yes, there's a lot of really great projects that are products, I should say, that are pending sales. There's some that are already completed. So,
Ooh, fun. And Liam, as always, thank you for engineering today's pod, and to Heritage Radio Network for doing all of the stuff so I don't have to think about monetizing anything. I can just interview people that I think are really smart and, you know, share them with y'all. And speaking of y'all, thank you all for listening and for all of the engagement. I think I said this on the last one, but it does bear repeating. Like, there were so many of you who came up to our booth at Expo just to say, you know, hello and, you know, thank you for the information. And I don't know that I was able to totally like take the time and focus my insane self on just really talking to each one of you, but it meant a lot to me. And I'm really appreciative that you took the time to thank me. And I love your suggestions, so keep them coming. And anything I can do to be helpful to your businesses as they grow, always DM me on LinkedIn. I am available. And I will be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.